You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of May 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, French voters head to the polls this weekend to vote for their next president. It's centrist Macron versus the far-right Le Pen. But is France in deep trouble, no matter who wins? I'm here with Monocle's Tom Edwards, Chris Lord and Henry Rhys-Sheridan to have that debate. Plus, safe zones in Syria, healthcare in America, the importance of English as a lingua franca, the Prince Philip worshippers in Vanuatu, and another airline PR nightmare. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. Today, as every Friday, it's an in-house affair. And my guests for that affair are Chris Lord, our former Istanbul bureau chief, newly relocated even to London as Monocle's new features editor, Monocle 24 executive producer Tom Edwards, and Monocle's associate producer, Henry Rhys-Sheridan. Welcome all to the programme. Let's start today with the French presidential election. Voters head back to the polls on Sunday for the second round of that election. It's widely expected that the centrist candidate, Emmanuel Macron, will beat his far-right rival, Marine Le Pen. Tom, we think that Macron is likely to be the winner, and that's good news in many ways, but it's also thought that Marine Le Pen could take as much as 40% of the vote. Now, as in the US election, in all these elections, does that still leave a country that feels rather kind of cut down the centre?
Definitely. I'm quite worried about this. I agree that Macron should win and win fairly comfortably. I know you've probably pointed out before, I think, Andrew, I myself have been a little complacent, but I think the polls and common sense tells us that that's the outcome. I think Macron's entree is going to be unenviable, to say the least. He has to galvanise support quite broadly in terms of domestic French politics. And even amongst the political classes, that's going to prove quite difficult for him because those who are left-leaning aren't really convinced by him, and those on the right will still probably express their loyalty to Marine Le Pen. And he's got some big challenges ahead, particularly on things like those old questions for France about structural reforms of the economy. He'll need a slightly more consensual approach to get things done. And to your point on a society that's split, I think we will see it. You've seen how bitter the narratives still are here in the UK post-Brexit. In the States, I think we're just starting to get towards exposing some of the fissures that actually, in a weird way, Trump slightly papered over, maybe also on the right. I think the country faces a really, really tough time, and we'll just have to be grateful that at least Le Pen hasn't won, where not only France will be under pressure, but I think the whole European project would have been.
And Henry, Marine Le Pen, yeah, she has a big constituency. Many people are very angered by what's happening in France, not just because of migration, which is obviously her touch point issue, but because of many of the issues that we've seen in the US, in the Brexit vote here in the UK. She represents a group of working class voters who feel that the story of globalisation hasn't been good for them. And there perhaps we have some empathy with those voters because many of their needs have been perhaps ignored. And again, it's this division between urban and rural and poorer cities and the bigger cities. If Macron gets in with a thumping majority and doesn't address that audience, do you think that he leaves France open to proper turmoil in the years ahead?
Well, I think that it can be, it would be an interesting test if Macron did get in, because what you would see then is a society with, I think you're right in identifying as having similar fissures to that which you see in the US and in Britain, in terms of there being, a critical mass of the population who feel left behind. But the result of that wouldn't have been an election where that group gets its cause voted in. It would be the other way around. So, you know, the liberal, cosmopolitan-minded people would have, quote-unquote, won. Their representative would be in power. And what would be interesting then, I think, to see is, you know, does that make a difference in terms of the tone of the country, the policies it adopts? And critically, you know, whether the people who now feel such resentment feel their resentment is alleviated in any way because of policies which are enacted or even conversations which are had. I'm rather sceptical. I think it's worth bearing in mind that these resentments festered under precisely the kind of centrist rational governance which Macron espouses and we are led to believe he would enact. I'm not sure if more of the same would make it go away. And, you know, even if the French feel like they've got away with it, if this particular election is won by Macron, you know, that energy will find a way to come out through some kind of valve somewhere in the future.
Chris, I'm a bit torn on this because on one hand, I think I feel the same, that, you know, that she represents a genuine constituency and manages to articulate certain concerns actually in a way which is very direct and brutal and honest, no matter how much you despise her politics. But on the other hand, there is here in the UK, we've just seen with some local elections here in the UK today, the Tories have addressed that audience since the Brexit vote and have done incredibly well. The far-right party here has lost nearly all of its seats in those local elections. And it shows you that while parties can have big followings, they ebb and flow much quicker than we imagine. Do you think that Macron can address those concerns? You know, as we say, he's a believer in the EU. He has, you know, worked for Hollande. You know, he's a former banker. But do you think that actually, if he's skillful, he could do a kind of a Theresa May and manage to undermine Le Pen over the coming years?
I think when I look at this election, I see it as very different from what happened with the Brexit vote and what happened with Trump, because France, in the run-up to this election, has become such a raw country. You know, we've seen over and over again terrorist attacks on its streets, the people themselves feeling that the country is somehow under siege, that it's under threat. And I think Le Pen has basically caught the wave of that fire. She's caught the waft from that fire, essentially. And I think also, ultimately, what she represents is an absolute disaffection with the way French politics has gone for so long. So with regards to whether Macron can actually bring everyone back on side, I think you have these two candidates who are obviously outsiders within that whole thing. He's going to inherit, if he does come to power after this weekend, he's going to inherit a very broken France with some real endemic problems about it. And I think also we have to remember that some of those core constituencies for Marine Le Pen are Pinois, or the descendants of Pinois, those people who felt disaffected by the collapse of the French Republic and the French Empire, the lot of people when they lost Algeria. Those are some of her key voters, people who feel very strongly about, you know, Vive France, the power of France. France needs to come up with a new narrative, I think, for the future. And I think if Emmanuel Macron wants to be successful, he has to be able to create a narrative that can be an inclusive for the modern France that is today, which is a pluralistic France, which is composed of many different religions and nationalities and so on and so forth. It needs to create something like that. Simply trumpeting globalization and globalism is not actually going to be enough. You're going to need to convince those young people in France who do move towards Front National that say, no, there is a narrative here that can still be France, that can still be pluralistic. That is, I think, is his big challenge.
Well, we'll see the election results on Sunday. But we're going to move to Syria now, where Turkey, Russia and Iran have just signed a deal to create safe zones within the country. According to the details of the deal, the use of all weapons will be banned and flights grounded in four of the country's regions starting tomorrow. Chris, we'll start with you again. Well, let's get our money's worth out of you. You know much of the mercurial politics and diplomacy that sat around this issue. Turkey's version of what a safe zone is and what the West version of a safe zone is, I think, will be rather different things, because Turkey's not going to want to say, OK, in the Kurdish areas, we promise we will never kind of touch you again, get on with your lives. They don't like the fact that the Turks hold so much, I mean, the Kurds hold so much ground within Syria.
That's absolutely right. I mean, this is, you know, we have to remember Ankara, from almost the start of the civil war, has called for safe zones across Syria. And part of the reason for that is because they want to make sure that the Kurds don't take too much territory. Now, the problem with these safe zones is, in many ways, there are some good things about this, but one of the key problems is it's a little bit too late. In as much as you've got now an entrenched, if you look at that map of Syria, that whole buffer, apart from a tiny bit of Turkish-occupied rebel, it's sort of Turkish-backed rebels that have occupied a tiny area, the rest is entirely Kurdish-held. And now, the trouble with this deal, obviously, is that the people that are at the table, you've got Vladimir Putin from Russia, you've got Iran, and then you've got Turkey as well. Now, one of the key people left out of this whole thing that's happened is the US. And the US has backed those rebels in the north of Syria, those Kurdish militias in the north of Syria. Look, there is, I think on one side, we can be very negative about this and sort of say, you know, how actually long-term is this going to be? Is this going to be just another one of those ceasefires that we've seen happen over and over again? The only thing is, we have to remember that Russia really, in many ways, holds the hand of this civil war, because so many of the things that stoke its anger, so many things that stoke its ferocity, are coming from the Assad regime. And Russia ultimately has the ear of Assad. He is the one who can tell him what to do. I think what happens here, if we have to remember, is that Russia has seen in April a terrorist attack in St. Petersburg by someone believed to be disaffected with what their actions are in Syria, where support for the Assad regime. Sanctions are continuing on Russia. It is starting to cripple the country even more. They need to come in from the cold. This ultimately, while you could be very negative about it, it's a sign that Russia has to do something. It has to find a way to bring peace to this scenario, because it's no longer the case that it continues to propagate it for its geopolitical interests, essentially.
Tom, it is interesting that there is no presence here of the US in the deal. You know, we've seen the one attack by the Trump government on Syria, on the Assad regime. In the end, there needs to be a much more broader alliance if this was going to stick, wouldn't there?
Absolutely. I think the problem here, and we said it almost till we're blue in the face, is you have to involve all the stakeholders. And yeah, Andrew, even going back to that Trump inspired assault on that airfield, you know, jets were taking off, I think, later that same day from the same airfield. So again, it was slightly empty. It was a gesture more than anything else. I mean, there's holes in this. They can still, I believe, they're covered to still strike within these designated safe zones if they find legitimate terrorist targets. Well, that's completely open-ended and inflexible. I'd like to be as optimistic as Chris is, even that this is a sort of baby step in the right direction. But to me, it rings a little hollow. And until, Andrew, you're quite right, all the stakeholders are around the table, I can't see this being resolved. And when's that going to happen?
The one thing I do want to say about this as well, and I think this is really Ankara and President Erdogan's naivety, is that I think they've underestimated how angry some of those rebels that they've been backing are and have become with the Ankara regime. I think the fact that Turkey is even doing business with Iran and with, to some extent, with Russia, who have been such supporters of President Assad, it is honestly creating a huge problem that's going to come back onto Turkish soil. We've already seen it in some ways, and it's just going to ramp up as time goes on.
Well, we're off to America now, where Donald Trump finally for some, has a legislative win in the form of a new bill to repeal and replace Obamacare. The bill, which we should point out, still has to go quite a long way before it actually becomes law, now faces a tough road ahead in the Senate. Henry, is this a good win for Trump? Is this a really a game changer, do you think?
I think it's a good win by Trump's own standards for himself, in the sense that it was, a victory which was won by his favourite method, that of negotiation and deal making, and then it gave him an excuse to have a massive party in his house, which I think is one of the foundational motivating factors in his personality. But, you know, it was remarkable the degree of fanfare that this was greeted with, considering, first of all, how far away this legislation, well, this proposal is from becoming law, and second of all, how, in my opinion, short-sighted and unsustainable the method of actually getting it through even this little first hurdle is, which is basically cobbling together a disparate and fairly rancorous group of Republicans to get the basically bare minimum amount of votes needed to get it through one chamber, again, I'll emphasise, of the US legislature. You know, this is not a sustainable way to realise a systematic vision for the country, if he had one. I think no one thinks he does. But yeah, it was, you know, some of the details, like I think they played the Rocky theme tune in the Republican kind of changing room before the final debate was had. You know, Republicans were jeering Democrats as they left the House. It's just really petty stuff happening in the chamber of the most powerful country on earth, and pretty depressing to my mind.
He's going to meet, or rather ahead of meeting Malcolm Turnbull, he praised Australia's universal healthcare system, which is this, of course, is the opposite of. But Tom, just looking at, you know, we've had the 100 plus days, I find it quite hard to know how much America has changed, not changed in substance, because, you know, he has had many failings. But it does feel that the country is slowly being pulled in a different direction, maybe not by the huge victories that he expected. When you look at America and you read about it, you know, you're here every day looking at the headlines and digesting what's happening. Do you see a changed America from 100 plus days ago?
I have to be honest, well, not really. And I certainly don't see many changes. I don't see this as an advance for Trump, other than, as Henry points out, a nominal victory for his deal-making powers. You know, we should remember that the Republicans control the White House and both houses. You know, he should have been able to facilitate movement on some of these key issues, and he's failed singularly several times. Yeah, the detail, Rocky theme tune, this kind of thing is funny. At the heart of this bill, I mean, it may yet get through the Senate and be enacted. It's a terrible, terrible deal. And what's quite striking here is that those who will be worst affected are likely to again be Trump heartland voters. And this will bite quick enough to come back on Trump and the Republicans, even possibly by midterms, should it go through the Senate. You mentioned there the idea that Trump's espoused Australia's universal healthcare system. He's quite consistently said that he thinks that's the best option. You know, even before he became a credible presidential candidate, he was a believer in universal healthcare. So the substance here flies in the face of everything that he said. So I fear, in answer to your main question, that it just seems like more of the same. And America still seems to me, legislatively at least, to be rather rudderless and still heading in a quite alarming direction.
Chris, we risk, you know, being in the same position as pre-election. You know, if you pick up a copy of, you know, The New Yorker, for example, you'll read, you know, will he be impeached? This is how it could happen. You'll read strong comments against him in The New York Times, in The Washington Post, even though they are doing their best to try and cover the other side of the story. But when you get closer to him and his supporters, there's still, of that 40% who back him, there doesn't seem to be any wavering. Are you surprised that despite his lack of successes, he continues to carry with him a constituency of people who back him whatever?
I think many of those people who will continue to back him whatever have kind of bought into the movement that he represents, the sort of anti-establishment side of it. I think, you know, we started by talking a bit about Marine Le Pen, and I think it's still all part and parcel of that, is that you catch the waft of anger and you can kind of, you believe it regardless. I mean, what does sort of strike me is that, you know, when we talk about those people, we don't really understand how that can possibly be, because everything's being thrown out. Everything that he came to power with is just being slowly knocked back. I mean, this hasn't even been ratified yet, and there's a good chance it's probably going to be knocked out as well. I don't know. It's very difficult to get a sense, because we do read so much via The New Yorker, via New York Times, to try and get a sense of the way people feel there in America. But it just seems that there is a kind of belligerent belief in him as a person and what he's going to do that just doesn't seem to be shakeable, regardless of these kind of things.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. I'll be back with Henry Rhys Sheridan, Tom Edwards and Chris Lord after this. Post-Brexit, do Europeans care about speaking English?
How do you take on Donald Trump? In the May issue of Monocle, we head to California, the base of the resistance, to meet the politicians fighting the good fight. We're also in Mongolia for a sit-down with the foreign minister ahead of their elections. We're in Tokyo to take a look inside Uniqlo's new headquarters, Bangkok for its bookstores, Seoul for its fashion, and just south of Melbourne to visit Australia's best designed hotel. It's our design and property special this month, so we'll bring you a heritage revival in Barcelona, meet some game-changing developers in Warsaw, Oslo and Kuala Lumpur, and we'll tell you which three small but brilliant firms you should commission for your next project. There's lots more, of course, from business to culture, entertaining to fashion, all inside the May issue of Monocle, out on newsstands and on monocle.com now.
You're listening to Midori House. Here with me are Monocle's Chris Lord, Tom Edwards and Henry Rees-Sheridan. Let's turn now to Brexit. Sorry about this. And in particular, to recent comments by Jean-Claude Juncker, President of the European Commission. In a press conference in Italy, and speaking in French, Juncker said that English is losing its importance in Europe. Henry, is he going a bit mad?
I don't think he is going a bit mad. I actually fully support him.
Are you wishful thinking, or you actually believe that people are speaking less English and care less about English?
I think that, well, listen, one of the reasons that English was adopted in the first place as one of the official languages of what was then the European Economic Community is because Britain joined. It makes total sense that now we're choosing to leave, they will begin to place less emphasis on that language. And I think that also, you know, we can only come to expect more of this in the future as a country's political significance declines in their membership of a particular group, or they make particular decisions which are belligerent to a particular cause or group, their soft power in that grouping will go with it. And I think that language is one of the most potent forms of soft power, and yeah, I can only see it waning.
Kind of, Tom, but I'm an arch Ramona and proud to be moaning every day about this. But surely the reality is that people speak English in Europe because they want to do business with China, with the United States, with Canada, with Australia, well, with New Zealand, with Africa.
It's disingenuous to say that the significance of English goes back to UK entry in 73 or whenever it was. I think the US is fundamental to this. That, you know, America made English the preeminent language of global business through the 20th century, and that isn't going to change. I have to say, what worries me slightly about this, I think Juncker again is going for a point scoring exercise. I can completely understand why he's doing it. Theresa May has been doing the same thing out of Westminster. But it's part of a broader concern of mine, which is that we are seeing time wasted and energy put into slanging matches, back and forth, political point scoring. Our general election is a distraction from Brexit. May's saying that the EU's trying to exploit the election to make political gain. All of this wastes time we don't really have to try and get a mutually beneficial deal. And I had hoped that Juncker might rein back a little. It seems to me like a bit of a point scoring exercise.
Chris, the only other two languages would be German. Try get the Greeks speaking German at the European Union. That would go down nicely. Or French. And I don't see that happening either, do you?
No, not at all. I think that the statement itself is so inward-looking of Juncker to do it. I mean, it's just as you know, I agree with what Tom said. It's so navel-gazing for him to do that, and so assumptive, basically, for the bloc. I mean, I think Juncker runs in a lot of danger of speaking too much for that bloc of very, very different nations. You know, does he, when he says things like that, does he speak on behalf of Estonia, which, you know, is trying to position itself as this global hub for technology and for e-businesses? Does he speak on their behalf? Or indeed, does he speak for German businesses who want to do business, as you mentioned, in America?
Well, do we just hope that both Juncker and May and others are deliberately pushing themselves to the margin? You know, that's often the opening gambit, isn't it? In any negotiating process, take the most arch position, and then that leaves you more room as you shift back
the
towards the centre.
That's
what I hope is happening.
Even with this whole thing that we've seen since that Brexit, you know, the disastrous Brexit dinner, isn't Juncker taking a little bit too much on the shoulders of what he thinks the European Union is or what the European Union stands for? I mean, you know, when he is leaking these, you know, as we assume, leaking these comments to the press, is he speaking on behalf of those Greeks who want to maintain a good relationship with the UK? Or, you know,
I think you've got to be careful of accusing him of being too introspective, though, in making his comments, because I think we're forgetting the second part of his justification for speaking French in this particular meeting. The first was that as you say, a bit point scorey. English is waning, got a big laugh. But the second with that, the French are having an election this Sunday, and he wants them to hear what he has to say about the importance of the bloc. Now, to me, that actually demonstrates a fairly canny awareness of the importance of the EU, which he's perfectly entitled to have a sincere faith in, and where he needs to target his statements in defence of that institution, given political realities.
Well, I was talking about Greeks earlier, and I'm going to stick with we're going to stick with another one, who's an old Greek gentleman who's now 95 years old, Prince Philip, husband of our Queen. He's stepping down from official duties. But on the Pacific Island nation of Vanuatu, though, there's a group of people who believe that Prince Philip is a gog. A gog? A god, even. He's part of a cargo cult there. And guess what? Chris Lordy has been there to meet the Philip worshippers. Tell us all about them.
All right, so there is...
I've got two minutes,
okay. It's a bit tricky, but there's a small group of people on the tiny island of Tanna, which is part of the Vanuatu nation in the South Pacific. And they believe that Prince Philip is a mountain god. And that the day he returns to the island, he will restore to them the rightful riches and freedom from illness that they've always wanted. Now, this is all part of as you mentioned, Andrea, cargo cults, which is down there in the South Pacific. All the big response to the missionaries that came in the 19th century, this idea that one day a man from overseas will come. And when I met these people, I asked them a little bit about what they believe. And they explained that, you know, that ultimately he was born of the mountain and he will return to the mountain. And now, as he's announced that he's going to retire, a lot of them are saying that the cyclone that hit Vanuatu at some time ago, in very recent history, was actually an omen of this forthcoming retirement.
Well, there you go. That's Prince Philip's vital importance to the Pacific explained in just 1 minute. Now, finally, you may think you've learned everything about airlines in America by now, but there's another scandal, and again, involving overbooking. This time, it's Delta's turn to be on the hot seat. A family was bumped off a flight recently in an incident involving a two-year-old's safety seat. It was all caught on camera, including a crew member's comments, who said that if the family didn't leave, then you and your wife will be in jail and your kids will be in foster care. Tom? Welcome it. Take my kids.
I mean, what is truly unbelievably extraordinary about this is where has that crew member, and it's quite clearly uttered in the entertaining but alarming videos online, where have they been over the past few weeks? I think even in those cargo cults of Vanuatu, people are well aware of the controversy surrounding United Airlines. You do not manage PR in that way, especially in the digital age of cell phone recordings and so on. It's absolutely staggering. I can only imagine now that people like this poor hapless family can almost sort of welcome this happening whilst filming it, thinking that they might get a healthy payout. But in PR terms, it almost begs belief. I was astonished. I thought this was a wind up, but it's happened again.
Henry, what do you think is behind this? Is it just that air crew in the US are badly paid, tired, fed up, don't like the old planes they're flying on, and take it out on us, the flying public, do you think?
Well, I think probably my understanding is that both the attitude of the air staff, which, as you point out, probably derived from them being, you know, badly paid, overworked, and the overbooking policy in the first instance are all symptoms of an extraordinarily competitive and difficult market to operate in. Now, the question is, you know, if you think that it is justified to overbook planes, if you think that it's just a justified move on the part of airlines, and I haven't heard too many arguments for or against that, that's not usually where the debate goes when an event like this happens. Well, you have to reconcile that then with what the consequences of that policy is, which is people getting kicked off planes. You know, if you don't want that situation to arise in the first place, we're going to have to ban or at least alleviate the overbooking of aircraft, which, you know, I'm not an aviation expert. I don't know whether or not that should be done. But, you know, it strikes me that the debate never travels there when these things get, you know, when these things get struck up. It's always to do with the particulars of, you know, the salacious footage that has been released or whatever.
Just a few seconds left, Chris. It strikes me that you've been in exactly this position this week. You've arrived at Monocle there was not a seat properly allocated to you. You were welcomed into the building, then they didn't give you a proper seat. The air stewardess, Tom Reynolds, asked you to move around several times, but you managed to remain calm. How did you do that?
That was when Tom Edwards sort of bashed me over the side of the chair and then dragged me slowly down the aisle, of course. But I mean, you know, for me, for this story, what I always think with this one, and I is sad for these customers, you know, they're treated wrong, and we get this all on film and so on. But the people I actually feel sorry for here are the airline staff, because they are the ones who are having to action this stuff that they're getting from above. And unfortunately, they're the ones who bear the flak from it.
Well, we'll see about that. That's all we have time for on Midori House. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Geriat. And our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. From me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.